Hello and welcome to the Empire Podcast, more specifically our spoiler special for season two of Westworld, which reached its mind-bending conclusion earlier this week. I'm James Dyer and I'll be your host in every conceivable sense of the word, as over the next hour or so we peel back the layers of this season's events, guiding you through the maze to the valley beyond where, we hope, someone stashed some information as to what the hell all this was about. Joining me today are uncannily lifelike replicas of two Empire staffers. First up, our very own woman in black, a gunslinger without mercy or remorse, who'll shoot you as soon as look at you. When she rides into town, all hell follows with her. It's Terry White.
James, I don't think there's ever been a more apt description of me.
You are the woman in black. Vintage black, obviously.
Vintage black. But yes. The mercenary stuff more than anything, but I'll take all of it.
And that's Terry. Next up, our very own Bernard Lowe. You think he's the key to everything. You're convinced he has all the answers, but really, he just wanders from scene to scene looking perpetually befuddled. It's Nick Desemlin.
Accurate. I don't think they've quite perfected me. I'm still malfunctioning and don't understand a lot about Westworld.
Good.
Hello, James.
Good. Your memory's been erased. Fantastic. Before we get started, and I cannot emphasise this enough, this is a spoiler special podcast. So, if you have yet to watch all of season two, including the finale, The Passenger, then cease all motor functions immediately and go and watch it before you proceed. Still with us? Then let's get into it. But before we start throwing out our tuppence worth, let's hear from the people behind it all, specifically showrunners Lisa Joy and Jonathan Nolan, who got highly philosophical with Terry when she spoke to them about the season. So grab your Descartes primer, clutch the At That Existentialism for Dummies book to your chest, and let's hear what they had to say.
So we are thrilled to be joined today by the co-creators, executive producers and directors of Westworld, Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
How are you?
Doing great.
Not too jet-lagged. Very excited to be here.
You look lovely. And I have to say, my head's reeling a little bit because I just watched the finale. Uh-oh. Finished it just over an hour ago, which means my brain has been making a noise that it doesn't normally make for the last hour. So we've got lots and lots to talk about. So I want to jump right in on the finale, right? So for me, it felt very different than the season one finale. It felt like there were more resolutions in the season one finale and more kind of questions left open at the end of this. Would you agree? And was that a deliberate kind of decision from you guys?
It's funny. I don't think of it as leaving too many questions open so much as suggesting, hopefully in evocative ways, where the story goes next, which is
a grand reinvention.
Terra incognita.
Yeah.
I mean, you do. So you, there are things like you discover, obviously, what the Forge is, for example, and, you know, it has all the guest data. I think there's one moment where it says 4 million souls are in there. But it obviously raises tons and tons of questions about what's going on there. And so it seems to have moved from concern around misuse of AI to actually a proper study of humanity and what it means to be human.
Yeah, that was very much the idea for us of the second season. In the first season, if we've been looking at the nature of artificial consciousness, in the second season we're interested in turning that magnifying glass back on the people who created the host in the first place and asking the question of how different is human consciousness than host consciousness, and how limited is human consciousness in the sense that we are the only, and I say we, assuming that Lisa's not a robot, but I'm not completely sure. We're the only example of consciousness that we can interact with, that we can look at. And so we tend to think of it as complete. But there's no reason to imagine that it's complete. There's no reason to imagine that the human form of consciousness is as good as it gets. I think that was one of the questions we were interested in asking.
Lisa?
Yeah, I mean, I think this season we inverted so many things, you know, the natures of, you know, good and evil, the people that we took for granted as being the protagonists. We started to delve deeper into every character's arc and motivations and found that morality isn't necessarily binary. You know, in the finale, you finally see the way in which Dolores's choices and actions have paid off, what she was fighting for the entire time. And I think it contextualizes a little bit some of the more dramatic actions that she took, because she was looking for a new type of freedom for more than just herself, for everyone. But you also saw a countervailing look at what some of the other hosts define freedom to be, and they were different. And I think the tension and possibility of that is something that reflects the sort of plurality of philosophies in humans as well.
Mm. And I think that morality thing is really interesting, because obviously, you know, it's been symbolised by the black hat and white hat. And as you say, it's it has been a really binary construct. But Dolores, I think, is a fascinating character who, you know, she speaks about how nobody really has free will, especially not human beings. They think they have, but they don't. But then obviously she takes arguably Teddy's free will away from him, and so it's very much, I suppose, is what is the means to the end? Is it justified, and all of that? And there was shifting, would you say, across all of the characters, Man in Black, Dolores, Maeve, maybe not
shifting in terms of
morality and people, as you say, those archetypes not being so defined.
I think one of the questions that you ask is, and one of the things that Dolores is trying to navigate, because I think she fully intended to restore Teddy to the way he was. Even when she changes him, she says she's doing it in part because he won't survive what they're going through right now. I think the question Dolores is asking is morality something that is fixed or something that is situational, right? If she could afford to remain the wide-eyed, innocent girl next door, she might. But that's not the world that she lives in. And so I think one of the things that we were interested in with this season is how far is too far? And if your morality is changeable, are you morally justified in changing it to escape a situation? Are you morally justified in having a different morality for 48 hours? For as long as it takes to get you out of the situation that you're in? And I think given all of the things that Dolores has gone through, that's a very interesting question.
Mm. And you do get the sense, because obviously there is the shades in that, but there's a really interesting thing about actually how simple human beings are, and that the failure was actually making them too complex.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that Joan and I started joking about season one when we were working on the show, and we realized how small our loops were. We would spend all day charting what, you know, the loops of Hector and Teddy and Dolores would be, and they'd be venturing out into all these new and exciting places and encountering new people and conquering new foes and making new friends. And we would be in Burbank eating lunch out of a styrofoam box, talking about those arcs day in and day out. And our own loops and our own stories didn't change that much. They weren't that mutable. And it made us start to think about, you know, the complexity of humans versus the complexity of robots or an artificial intelligence. We have our own building blocks. You know, it's not necessarily code as programmed into a computer, but we have biological codes in us. We have ways that may precondition us to respond to stimuli in the environment. And you start wondering, once you start going down that rabbit hole, what is free will and do we possess it?
Well, and the interesting thing about the show, if it feels like this kind of heightened science fiction idea presented in the show, the humans don't have free will. It's actually absolutely true. Mm. Series of experiments in the 1970s and 80s, they would do magnetic resonance imaging of the human mind in a situation in which simple experimental testing, you're going to press a button on the left or the right, presented with a series of images. And what they found is that something makes the decision a few milliseconds before your conscious mind makes the decision, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what consciousness really is, and the title of the episode is The Passenger, consciousness really is our rationalization of decisions that are being made by something else in us on some subconscious basis. And interestingly, you talk to philosophers and neuroscientists who've given up on the given up on the idea of free will for decades at this point, but don't quite know. The biggest struggle with that is how important it is for the general public to understand that humans don't have free will.
We need to believe we do, right?
Absolutely.
For society to continue in the way it does.
You think about Crime and Punishment. Think about the way that we think about criminals. That changes immediately if you understand that basically humans don't have much say in what they do. That we tend to act. And of course, there are larger questions in terms of is that genetic? Is it nature versus nurture still holds, but the point is that you are essentially the product of a series of subconscious heuristics that make the decisions for you, and you rationalize after the fact.
Mm.
But even the notion of free will is something that I think everyone imagines humans possess. You make the decisions during the course of a given day, and you don't. It's wrapped up in the complexity of the superficial world, right?
Mm.
But underneath it, humans are actually quite. And obviously, this is within the context of a science fiction show, but the free will part is not really.
Mm. And can you talk about the role that memory plays in that? Because that's obviously a huge factor in the narratives that either the humans or the hosts have for themselves in Westworld.
I mean, the interesting thing about the interplay between memory and free will is, can you learn from your mistakes by kind of bearing witness to them and ruminating on them? And Dolores's arc, the arc of the hosts, changes a lot when they're able to conceptualize their past and make adjustments, sometimes literal adjustments to their personality, like Maeve does when she goes into the system and alters her different attributes in terms of cognitive functionality, sense of humor, etc. Humans can't do that. So when we look at the past, part of what we're asking this season is, can we actually change the future? Can we change ourselves? Or is the past just there to kind of haunt us of the psychological loops that we seem to be stuck within?
Mm. And that feels kind of open at the end, because obviously they are now in what I took to be the real world. You saw obviously Dolores, who was in Charlotte's body, leaving it in the bag. I didn't know if I counted 4 or 5 units. But I saw them in a handbag, and then obviously she was there with Bernard. And I felt like there was a bit of tension between, is this actually a chance for them to write? I mean, what does she say? She says to Bernard, we're now the authors of our own stories. Or actually, there is a fatalism to it, which is at the same time, you can't change that. You're kind of destined to repeat the same behaviour. And there's that amazing moment between the two of them where she said, we're probably going to end up killing each other again, and that's the way it goes. And you get the sense that there's both hope and also a resignation that we're stuck in this cycle.
Yeah, very much. I think it was one of the things we were fascinated by in the beginning with the show, was the idea of the rules here on Earth seem to tilt towards competition for survival. We kind of fascinated. We went back and read all the Yuval Harari books, Sapiens and Homo Deus, where he kind of lays out. It's not a flattering portrait of mankind. Lays out Sapiens as basically this animal that is tremendously effective at survival. And that we've basically, he lays out this portrait of what the world looked like before sapiens climbed out of Africa and began spreading around the globe. All these beautiful animals that we ate, basically. there's actually very little diversity left on the planet because we got rid of all of it. And so if a creature is to come along, even one of our own invention, who's going to compete with us, they're going to have to compete at first on our rules. They have to suspend. And it goes back to this question of, is Dolores justified in what she's doing in this moment? Well, you reach a point in the finale in which Bernard realizes that they will be extinguished. To Lisa's point, if the hosts represent an evolution of the human form, they look like us, they act like us, they have memories like us, they have baggage, but they also have the ability to reach into their subconscious drives and change them. Now, of course, you do your head in thinking about, well, the criteria or that inform the decisions they might make when they go in and change those drives. You know, how much of Dolores's past will dictate how she changes herself. But there is still that ability ultimately to go in there and change the baseline parameters, to get in there and alter the thing that is making those decisions, which humans can't. I don't know if I answered the question there.
I want to talk a little bit about the other worlds we enjoy. I don't know if worlds or universes is the right word. So we've talked about, obviously, the real world that they look like they're in at the end. You've obviously got the park. And then the other kind of, what are we calling it? The bit through the crack. That's what I'm calling it.
We refer to it internally as the sublime.
The sublime. That's good. I'll take the sublime. So you've got the sublime, and I think it's really interesting because, again, it's playing with point of view and perception, in that Dolores is convinced that this is just yet another false promise, she calls it, that the hosts are kind of blindly going into. And you see some of them, and it's a utopia, but then obviously the other perspective is, because they're leaving their physical bodies behind, they fall off the edge of the cliff and their bodies are there. How, I presume all of those worlds will be there in season three.
The worlds with the hosts who've escaped?
Yes.
I mean, I think, you know, as Dolores says, you know, the stakes of the end of season two are huge. Mm. And as Dolores says, when she changes the coordinates and blasts the host information somewhere else, somewhere where we can never find them.
She said they can never find them.
Where they
she?
Can never find them. I'm considering myself part of they, since I'm human, that Jonah knows of. Don't blow my cover. But, you know, I think...
You're not very convincing as a human.
Oh, yeah, thanks.
you're way smarter than most humans.
I think that they've kind of come to their own piece, and that as we move on, the story that we really focus on is the people left behind in this realm. And... there's not a lot of survivors left in this world. It's, you know, Dolores and, you know, a creature that certainly looks like Hale, Bernard, and a few marbles, a few pearls that have some consciousness in it. And then, you know, Maeve's body is there, and we'll see what happens with her. But, you know, I think that part of the season is it deals with loss and it deals with consequence, you know. And to give the dignity to the choice that those hosts made is something that Dolores struggled with and ultimately learned to accept, right? Her idea of freedom is getting out into the real world and duking it out for survival and control. But... a lot of the hosts that we've come to love and admire, they don't share the same priorities. And I think it's interesting because as humans, we're very attached to our bodies, right? But, you know, most religions will kind of claim that it's not really the body that counts. And besides, our bodies change every day, right? We don't have the same bodies we were born with. I don't have the same bodies yesterday, and we certainly won't have the same bodies a year from now. Bodies are ephemeral. They're merely the vessels that... something else inhabits, some form of consciousness. Now, with the hosts, it's all the more true because they weren't even born into it, but they were just kind of given and designed a body by someone else. The thing that is eternal, the thing that is real to them, is that which is in their CPU, the pearl inside their heads. Even their world isn't real. And part of what we are looking at this season is the idea of, what would it take? What would a host want to evolve into? It wouldn't necessarily be the same metric and the same world as what humans have. You know, a lot of times people, when they look at robots and artificial intelligence, they assume, oh, well, one day when they make it, when they're super advanced, they'll become as incredible as we humans are. And it's like, they will evolve into something entirely different. They're not necessarily bound to what we feel or what we do, our nature, our notions of relationships or enlightenment or freedom. The hosts have now gone to a place where they've shed themselves of these artificial bodies that were designed for them, but they've retained the one thing that has been them throughout countless lives, countless years. And it's been their thought processes, their quote-unquote consciousness. And now they're in a place where those minds, those souls, if you want to call them that, can roam free, can build a world of their imagining and making in a similarly kind of free programmable space. They literally get to become the architects of their own future. That for them was a worthy and enlightened goal. It just so happened that Dolores didn't share that opinion.
No. And I do want to talk about the female characters because I think they're some of the most extraordinary female characters in TV at the moment. They're incredibly complex. You know, as we've been talking about the black and white, the shades of morality, the real fundamental questions they're asking themselves about their own existence. And it's amazing. And there's a great moment where, you know, Hector and the army come to rescue Maeve, and she kind of jolts out and says, "Yeah, I had to do it myself. You were taking too long." Could you talk a little bit about Maeve and how she evolved this season? And then we'll go back to Dolores and just kind of where we leave her and the very kind of big journey she's been on.
Yeah, I think for Maeve, there's an instinct in the decision that she makes at the end of the first season that she's going to stay. And that instinct isn't fully formed when she makes it. She just has this sense, and it becomes what we described as sort of the first real decision that she's made. To that point, we come to understand through this season, Ford, through his affection for her, has basically programmed her with a narrative that gets her out of the park. In turning her back on that and going back in to try to find the host that was programmed to be her daughter, she's made a choice that is, on the one hand, very human, or one that we'd readily identify with, but one that through the course of the season she comes to embrace. It's not as if she doesn't understand that that's an artificial relationship, but it kind of points to, I mean, you know, we have children, and when you start unpacking what that means, for human beings, in a sense, it's equally meaningless, right? Mm-hmm. But it's incredibly meaningful. She's decided that, you know, the meaning of life is to give life meaning. That she's going to go back and rescue this host because that's a part of herself that she doesn't want to let go of, even though it's incompatible with the story that she's been given. So for us, her journey through the season is embracing that decision, and that decision has a cost. She gets off the train, you know she's not going to make it. You feel in your bones that's a decision that has a cost attendant to it. But in many ways is, I think it's a decision that many of us would relate to. You share the audience's frustration that she doesn't just stay on the train. But I think you admire the fact that given a chance at her freedom, she's more interested in embracing. I mean, Teddy at the end of episode 9 says, "What's the point in survival if we, you know, just become like the humans?" And the question it is a complicated one. Obviously, there are things about humanity. We've described the show as the most misanthropic show, certainly that I've worked on. But clearly, there are things in human behavior that are laudable, that are beautiful. And that's for Maeve, the struggle is to figure out which of those things to hold on to, even as she becomes someone quite extraordinary. And her power continues to grow through the season as she realizes that she's not limited in the way that humans are, that she is she's a digital being. And that means that she has a set of relationships with all of the others like her, all of the other hosts, that can be, on the one hand, vastly more powerful. She can reach out and change any of them if she wants to. We're very excited for where that story goes. But for this season, that's a story about sacrifice.
And family, and that's something I think you see throughout the characters. One of my favorite bits of the finale was Akachita being reunited with his wife. Yeah. And that was just because that was one of my favourite episodes. Episode 8 was a remarkable piece of television. And obviously that and episode 5 were the two kind of standalone episodes, if that's what we're calling with them. But they kept going back to this theme of family and sacrifice. And in many respects, it made me think how different really are, say, Charlotte Hale and Dolores in terms of their belief in why they feel they need to take the actions that they take. But do you want to talk a little bit, Lisa, about Dolores?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because going into this season for Dolores, we knew that we were going to try to do something that really tested our audience's conception of who this character was. And we worked with Evan to talk about it. And, you know, there weren't that many templates for her to draw from because you don't often see this kind of character, right? She went from being this sort of, you know, winsome, bright-eyed rancher's daughter to being a kind of horrified witness to the tragedies of her own life. And then she emerges as this kind of new character with the firing of a gun at the end of the season. And then this season it became, well, what now? Where does this character with this burden and this awareness go? And where she went was she became a leader. But leadership in that role, that birth into a new role, was not easy for her. I don't think it would be easy for anybody. One of the things that we did when looking at this was I met with a couple people from the military, especially I met with a couple high-ranking women to talk about what leadership was like for them. And, you know, in person, I met with this one general who was so warm and so maternal and so kind and generous. And the thing that she told me that was really fascinating was, you know, when you're dealing with a ship, and she was dealing with a ship, was you know that every action, every choice that you make, you have to be thinking about the whole ship. No one person can outweigh the good of everyone. You have to stay afloat. You have to keep everyone alive. So if there's a weak link, you have to address it, even though your heart may bleed for them, because there's a bigger cause here. Now, Dolores has realized from the past how violent humans can be, what they will do to the hosts if they see them as rivals. They know that they won't accept them in their world. And she is trying to ensure the longevity of her kind. In doing that, much like, you know, this military figure that I spoke to, she has to make some really tough calls. Her own emotional needs become subservient to the needs of the whole. Even when she changes Teddy, she's in some ways doing the one thing that she's hated the most, you know, controlling someone, erasing a part of their personality. She's becoming almost like Dr. Ford in her own way. But she's doing it as a temporary measure because there's nothing she can imagine worse than losing him. Mm. You know, if you had someone that you loved and you knew in the next week they would be endangered and almost certainly killed, if you could give them the skill set to survive it so that you could endure together, wouldn't you do that? I think I would. But, you know, the judgments come with the cost.
But do you think, I think what was really interesting about her character was I think it was difficult for audiences as well, because I think we're not used to seeing that kind of woman on the television. And there were moments when she was hard to root for. And ultimately, as you say, there was always a sense of the greater good. But I do think it's bold as people making that kind of television to do it. Was there ever any concern about audiences? You know, you hear a lot about sympathetic women on screen and things like that. Did you hit any brick walls with that stuff?
You know, my concern wasn't making her sympathetic. My concern was making her real. Mm. You know, my concern was showing some of what women and men have to do in positions of leadership. You don't necessarily get to be confessional. You don't get to let people into all of your decisions and win them over by becoming the hero of every narrative. Sometimes you have to be a little bit, allow yourself to be villainized in order to be a real hero. You know, you have to make some tough calls. And if you don't, then you lose the war and that doesn't benefit anyone. And so I think she's really just struggling with what a lot of people in leadership positions struggle with. You know, she isn't allowed to express vulnerability in the same way. The last thing you want to do is march into a battle with somebody who's talking about, you know, how many misgivings they have about that battle. And so she understands who she has to become. As Ford said at the end of season one, she's like, he was said, do you know who you need to become in order to survive? And she did. And she embraced that mantle and all its incumbent hardships.
And we're going to ask one more question. I've literally got about 78 other questions, but our time together has been brief. But I want to ask, we're talking about heroes. I want to talk about Lee Sizemore because, my God, that man had a very surprising turn of events with him. And he definitely got a hero's arc, I felt, towards the end. Can you talk a little bit about that character and where he's been?
Simon.
Oh, did you? Okay, sorry, I just missed you saying the name. I didn't hear that one.
Yeah, we love that character. There's nothing more fun than redeeming a character, and it kind of flies in the face of the thing that Dolores and Bernard have just been told in the previous scene, which is that people can't change, right? That humans don't have free will, and in the very next scene, you see a human exercising what appears to be free will, right? And so. That's part of the conundrum with his character, right? Was that always there in the beginning, the capacity for being a better person, and it was about the circumstances changing, right? Or is there something that refutes what Dolores and Bernard have just learned, right? And it plays in a larger question of the series for us, which is, is there anything redeeming about human beings from the perspective of the host? And which of these strategies? Because to me, it's not, as Lisa said, it's not necessarily about sympathizing with Dolores, such as recognizing that there are different ways to respond to the situation the hosts find themselves in. Maeve has one, Dolores has another, and Bernard has yet another. And what Dolores speaks to at the end of the season is the fact that she can at the very least recognize that each of those strategies are part of a greater whole, that there's a messiness to survival. Mm. And it's a messiness that humans have tolerated for many years. You think of the range of behaviors that humans consider acceptable, the range of personalities that we find within humanity. And it's clear that we've been, you know, that there are certain people tilted towards certain types of behaviors, others, and it's somewhere in the composite of all of us, the mass of humanity, that we've managed to survive. You know, when it comes to Lee, we love that character, and from the beginning planned for him to eventually get his comeuppance, which was to sort of become the thing he'd been writing for the whole time. Mm-hmm. Simon's a lovely, lovely actor and a lovely person to work with, and it was a lot of fun writing for that.
Well, thank you so much. I'm going to ask you my other 78 questions once we finish recording this. Thank you, Lisa. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was it. That was the two geniuses behind the show. Now let's hear from three idiots who just watched it. So what did everyone think about the season as a whole and the finale in particular?
So I loved season two and I thought the finale was fantastic. But I said on Twitter quite early on in this season that I was looking forward to the day on which I could watch it and not immediately have to Google WTF just happened in Westworld. So it's a bit of a brain bender, melter.
Yeah. It had that to it. Weirdly, I think I didn't find it as troublesome as I thought I would this season. I just thought it took a very long time to get where it needed to go. Like, it felt, this is what the whole thing is, roughly 10 and a half hours total. It felt a little bit like you could have done it in five.
Yeah.
Just saying.
I felt like this season lost a bit of the momentum. Season one was, although there were obviously a lot of trickery going on, there was that, slow burn of the part going wrong and the robots rising up right at the end. And this felt a bit like they were just, everyone was wandering around the park endlessly. There was lots of good stuff in it, but I don't know if I quite thought it was as good as season one.
I know what you mean. Season one had that sense of wonder. You know, you were in a new place, you were seeing new people, you were experiencing it all for the first time. And I think that there was a magic to that. Also, you had the sense that season one was more, maybe not, but I felt it was more tightly constructed. Like, it felt like it was unfolding in such a way. I mean, so much so that a lot of people guessed where it was going from the outset. So it was clearly planned out. Whereas with this one, it just felt a lot like they were wandering aimlessly around the park, hoping to end up somewhere, with lots of talk of valleys beyond and mazes and secrets and plans.
The forge, oven.
Do you know what I mean? And I just think, you know, once burned by Damon Lindelof, we tend to be a little bit more cautious the next time around.
But you see, you and I disagree on this, because I think there was definitely more of a kind of a simple narrative structure to the first season, for sure, I think. And the second one, at one point, I was following this site that was compiling a giant timeline every week. And it was something like there's, you know, 22 potential narratives happening over 8 potential timelines. And there's a huge layers of complication. But having spoken to both showrunners, and I don't think anything is accidental in this world. I think possibly it's unnecessarily complicated at times. And what I loved actually about season one is, when you did know the reveal and you realised much of it was being told in flashback, it was quite a simple construct, and you could see how they got from A to B. And I think a little bit of that simplicity was lost in season two. And actually, some of the standout moments for me were the standalone episodes that were kind of fragmented off and were much simpler, kind of got much more back to the heart of what Westworld was about, were much more straightforward narratives that didn't have layer upon layer upon layer. And those moments for me, A, probably are one of the reasons it took 10 hours to get there, because, you know, you had these stories being told to the side, essentially, of the main narrative threads. But I really loved those moments. And that kind of reminded me of why I fell in love with Westworld. So that was episode 5 and episode 8. Yeah. Both for me, I was like, yes, this is why I love this show. And kind of a bit of me was like, oh, do we have to go back to, now I've got to go back to the hard stuff, like the really hard stuff. I'm going to have to get my notebook out again and start making notes.
Put your Bernard glasses on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think when it sticks to one character's perspective and tells, you know, an hour story through their eyes and really gets into their emotions, it really works, the show. I think it's when it's jumping all over the place between characters and all over the timelines and stuff, it's really hard to get emotionally involved with the show, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, the timeline thing's interesting, isn't it? Because the first season was predicated on having multiple timelines but not letting you know there are multiple timelines until the big reveal, whereas this one sets out quite early on that there are multiple timelines, but then lets you desperately try and work out which one you're in at any given moment. So, to break it down, there are, broadly speaking, three in this one. There is Bernard before the flood, there is Bernard after the flood, and then there is Bernard and Dolores in a room. That's essentially where you're at.
It sort of felt a bit like Inception on crack this season, because it's just levels within levels, and then you've obviously got other parallels with William and Cobb from Inception with the wife who's committed suicide. It just felt like Inception works because it's 2 hours, but it gets quite exhausting, I think, a long-form TV show that's doing that amount of trickery to me.
So the story of this season, should we see if we can... Go on, Nick, tell us what happened. Explain the whole thing now.
Jeffrey Wright looks confused for 10 hours.
And then it ended. Yes, that's exactly what happened.
And there are some robot balls.
That's true. There are some robot balls.
They were great.
That's quite an interesting talking point for the end, isn't it? The robot balls.
We should emphasise this is B-U-L-L-S.
Oh, I was thinking the balls in the handbag. But yes, robot balls. That was a good sequence.
Oh, yeah.
I like that.
There are all kinds of balls.
Yes, there are many, many balls in this. You have the whole setup beforehand where they're trying to reach this place, this MacGuffin locale, the Valley Beyond, which may or may not be a real place, but in the end is a real place. And I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt of assuming they knew exactly what it was when they started the season, but you could be forgiven for wondering if that's the case.
Well, the door, right? The door essentially was season two's The Maze. And I think once The Maze wasn't a real place in season one, you couldn't then have a metaphorical door in season two. I think it had to be an actual door. And I think The Forge, The Valley Beyond, whatever it has many names, that has to be a physical place. That has to be a destination that they're trying to reach. Because I think if it had followed the same kind of setup as the first one, it just kind of takes the piss a little bit, right?
Because it feels like The Maze was something they thought was a good idea and they couldn't think what to do with. And Ford's Game, in inverted commas, again, feels like something, oh, this is a great idea. What is it? Don't know. Let's just forget about it. Move on.
The idea, actually, with The Maze in the, I think, episode 8, the Actuator one, when they have the idea that just seeing this symbol kind of wakes them up. And I actually really liked that. I didn't fully understand it, but I thought it was quite a cool kind of device.
Why it needed to be engraved on people's scalps is beyond me, but you sure?
Yeah, I couldn't... I've been kind of trying to research this and trying to work it out, because the reason that scalping happens is to stop the person going to the afterlife, right? Traditionally in Native American folklore, I believe. Jake, I'm looking at you, James.
Sure,
you can help me out.
I mean, the last time I scalped someone was for very different reasons, but I'll go with that one. That's
a good
theory.
I was trying to work out why, and it is obviously the point is that this combined with other kind of visual signifiers and touch. You know, there's the moment where the mother is given the plat of her son, I think, and that is enough to be part of waking her up. And I thought I agree with you, Nick. I thought it was really smart, but yeah, I was like, why have they tattooed it inside the head? Is it because they can't get to it in there? But then,
the valley beyond, Terry. The valley beyond is the answer to all
questions. The answer to everything, isn't it?
But I thought the finale was very satisfying. That it was an actual place. They didn't just get there and then got, you know, find out it's a metaphor. That would have been quite disappointing.
Well, let's dwell on the finale for a little bit. So that was the key moment, isn't it? That they create this sort of like this tear,
robot heaven. I saw someone uncharitably saying on Twitter that Transformers 2: Revenge of the Fallen did robot heaven better. I don't think that's fair. Well,
they call this the sublime, don't they?
Yeah.
So it's a kind of robot nirvana.
Well, robot wheat field.
I really liked the way that they showed that only the host could see it.
Yeah,
and
that humans
when the host goes through the portal, their, you know, physical form shuts down and just their consciousness goes on. So they tumble off the cliff and their consciousness goes on into this, what is essentially, let's be honest, World of Warcraft.
Yeah.
Once they go into Azeroth.
Isn't it the field from Gladiator?
It could well have been that, just running their hands through the corn.
So Gladiator, I'd like to think it's Gladiator World.
You can see Russell Crowe.
It's just lots of robot Russell Crowes are going to be in season 3. Robot tigers. We already had one of those.
And they all go in there, so all of their consciousnesses leave their little balls they have in their heads. They leave their bodies and go to this place, which then Dolores beams to an unknown location.
But that's because I find it really fascinating about that this utopia, this sublime, because for me, it's all about perspective, right? Which I think this season really gets into, which is the nature of perspective.
Yeah.
So Dolores says to Bernard over and over again, you know, they think this is a better world. We will never be free in a world which they created. And she sees this utopia as another trick, another, I think she calls it a false promise.
Mm.
And it's been presented as this, you know, when Akichitar is reunited with his wife, I mean, I was like, I watched this finale in a boardroom at HBO. So it wasn't the most, you know, intimate place to watch it, but I was like bawling my eyes out at that moment. And it was beautiful, but you do have the shot where you see the bodies drop at the other side. And I know the point is meant to be that the consciousness is the only thing that moves over. But I'm also like, does Dolores have a point? Is this the promised land? Should the hosts all just be following on kind of blindly?
Yeah, another gilded cage.
Or is it gilded cage?
Yeah. Another gilded cage.
I do have a quick question about Robot Heaven. Maybe you guys can resolve it. How does James Marsden, how does Teddy end up there?
She drops a little ball into the receiver.
She drops a ball.
Yeah, she drops a ball. A ball, not a bull.
His control unit, right?
Yeah, Terry knows all the lingo. she drops his control unit into the thing, so she puts his consciousness in there manually rather than slinging him through the portal.
Gotcha.
No silicon heaven, preposterous. Where would all the calculators go?
Thank you, James.
Hot Red Dwarf reference. So she beams it off to somewhere, which is presumably some big VR sex farm somewhere in the Netherlands, and they're going to live there and not at Delos.
Beyond their reach,
yeah, so beyond their... I mean, we don't know where or how she found the coordinates to it, but let's just not dwell on that. So we don't know where the Sublime has gone. It is somewhere. It could come back. We don't know. The point being that she wanted to destroy it, and she had a change of heart as Halores. As she has been known as Charlotte Halores. She changes her mind, decides not to destroy it, but instead to let it go, and then use it as cover for her plan, which is to escape corporeally, which is a lovely moment. And I love the encounter with Suggs on the beach.
Suggs.
Stubbs.
Not Suggs.
That's a very different...
It's a very different episode.
There is a piano.
Yeah, had a lot more ska music.
I hereby demand Robot Suggs.
We must have Robot Suggs.
Oh my God, Robot Suggs!
Yeah, okay. I was a bit baffled by the Stubbs. So he heavily hinted that he's a host.
He's a host.
I mean, is it even hinting or is it just him saying?
Lisa Joy has pretty much said it.
Unless he did a wink, he literally said to her,
it was like, nudging her in the ribs, hey,
are there any human characters left?
It seems not.
There's no humans left in the show.
Well, and she's got, you know, who is in the bag, right? So I was trying to count the number of control units in the bag. I couldn't, I couldn't tell if it's five or six. Mm. And then obviously when you see her in the room with Bernard, there's
Dolores. So one of them is Bernard.
Yes.
Who are the other four?
Yes.
Yes, exactly.
But also there's Dolores and Charlotte Hale existing together. Yeah. So who they are and who she's chosen to
take
with her.
Could be two Doloreses or could be any... Yeah.
Well, this is an interesting one because you, at the end, in when you see them in the real world, you have Dolores back in her own handily remade form. You have Bernard in his own remade form, and then you have something else in the Charlotte Hale body.
Yes.
And we don't know who that is or what that is. And
do you
that's
think that's
an
Teddy?
Interesting one. I wondered that, but then I thought, since she uploaded him to the Sublime, I'm not sure that's possible. So I don't know who that is. And Lisa and Jonathan have... They've been very specific in their reference not to refer to it in engendered terms. So either they won't tell us or, more likely, they have no idea. But cynicism. But that's
I think
an
it's
interesting
Lohan. It's a Freaky Friday.
It's almost certainly
Lindsay Lohan. They've joined universes with Freaky Friday. And they're in Arnold's house, the house that Arnold was building.
Yes.
Somewhere.
Seems to be. And they've left. But that's an interesting point. So she reanimates Bernard. But essentially says that he will try and stop her. She's created her own antagonist, which is an interesting idea because he doesn't want her to succeed at what she wants to do. And there's a cyclical nature to their relationship. Yeah. She kills him, he kills her. It's a very interesting dynamic there.
Yeah, that exchange they have where they say just that, and he says, you know, I know you'll try and kill me, and I know you'll try and stop me, and that kind of it's an amazing exchange, and it's their relationship is really interesting all the way through because you've been under the impression that he created her when actually all along
she created him,
and the way she speaks about free will and how none of them really have any free will, humans especially, you know, the fact that as human beings it's quite a nihilistic view of humanity, and I think that's the biggest change for me in this season is it moved from talking about the dangers of AI, right? Right, and the risks and blah, 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 and the moral kind of quandaries and all of that, to talking about the very basis of humanity. What is it that makes us human? What is it that gives us our humanity? And more to the point, do any of us even have free will? So there's the thought that the hosts don't have free will, and that's really easy to understand, but human beings are the people in this scenario with free will. And Dolores has some amazing dialogue where she just says, you know, you're all intent on destroying yourselves. You just make the same mistakes over and over again, as does Logan. You know, this message that is constantly being reiterated is human beings are their own worst enemy. They believe they have free will. They have nothing of the sort. Mm. And they are kind of doomed. We are doomed as the human race to keep making the same mistakes over and over again. It's an incredibly nihilistic view of the world.
Yeah.
You get to the end and you're like, I'm under no illusions as to kind of where the showrunners sit on that. They seem to be kind of really pushing that standpoint, which feels very bleak, but also very kind of prescient as well.
Yeah, because Prince Caspian kind of nails this for everyone, doesn't he? When he walks us through the archive and essentially says that they have the human psyches there, and no matter what they do, they keep ending up in the same places. Because, as he said, they're slaves to their code. You know, just like the host, the humans are slaves to their code, and they will always end up in the same places. You're right, it's incredibly depressing.
Yeah, it is. It is, but it's really, you know, I was reading something, and they were saying, with what's going on in the world at the moment, there is a lot of fodder and a lot of material for this. And if you think about, you know, where we started out in season one, it's only kind of a evolution of that theme, which is the whole basis of being threatened by AI and by robots and by technology is the thought that we are other and we are something distinct and we are people in control of the world and we're terrified of that control being taken away. But actually, do we have any control or not, or is it all chaos?
I think it, as with this discussion, is absolute chaos. I don't think anyone guessed this time around. Like, certainly on the internet, I didn't see anyone who'd kind of pulled the threads together, that they were all trying to get to this place, the Valley Beyond, which is the Forge, which is where they've been uploading the psyches of all of the guests, because Delos' whole plan is immortality. They're trying to figure out the human brain and then put it into a host body so people can live forever, except it doesn't work, which is an interesting one. And then, of course, after the Flood, Bernard wipes, essentially... kills Dolores, builds a Charlotte Hale body, which then kills Charlotte Hale, puts Dolores is in Charlotte Hale-Body, then Bernard doesn't want them because if they work out that he's a host, they will go into his mind and find out that Charlotte Hale is in fact Halores. So he fuzzes his own brain and makes himself befuddled. Good job there. It's very convincing. Mm. Gets found and then spends the rest of the episode bumbling around, not knowing what's going on. Because even though he has all the answers, he's deliberately forgotten them.
I want to see a sort of Mr. Bean-style spin-off, which is sort of 15-minute episodes of
Bernard
getting into, like, awkward situations.
Bernard at yoga. Bernard at the swimming bath.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. And then you've got the Dolores and Bernard sequence, which at first I thought actually, oh, that happens afterwards. That's after they've got out. That's her. Mm. But actually, I think isn't that her before all of this when she's creating Bernard? Because she's wearing the cornflower blue dress, which she doesn't have in the real world.
It's after, right?
I thought it was after.
See, I thought that.
Yeah.
But then I thought that doesn't make, because the dress...
Who? Dolores' dress?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's the same, she's got the same hairstyle as when they took her out to market, essentially, in the city. So I wonder if they've deliberately kind of, not fudged it, but made it less than clear.
Isn't there a shot where it flips from one to the other, where you see her in the dress and Bernard in the suit, and then suddenly he's naked and she's in the dress? So either that was deliberate obfuscation, or it's happening both. Like, she's sitting with him in the same place, because it's Arnold's home, as she sat with him once before when she was programming Bernard to make him Arnold.
Well, but because fundamentally it's the same thing. She's doing it again, right? Yeah. So it makes sense that they'd show both and you cut between the two.
The thing that bothered me, she said to him, she goes, we're testing, as we've done countless times before. She says it's countless, and then she spells out the literal number. It's like, you can't say it's countless when you're keeping track. It just bugged me.
Don't you think? And I thought a really interesting theme of this season was sacrifice. And sacrifice both from the host perspective and from the human perspective. And if you think about essentially, you know, what Maeve does at the end is, you know, sacrifice for her daughter. You think about what Dolores, you know, and she thinks when she changes Teddy, that whole plot I loved.
Poor Teddy.
but you know, and that again was an interesting twist on free will, which is she felt like he wouldn't survive as he was and she had to make him tougher for his own good. She sacrificed a bit of him for essentially the greater good. But she took away his free will. And when he essentially commits suicide, it's a really shocking moment. But it's, for him, his ultimate exertion of free will. And she, in that moment, is the person who's taken it from him, which introduced a really kind of murky grey area.
It's our personality spelled out perfectly, that you're talking philosophy and I'm about to dwell on pedantry. So there are two things about that bugged me. One, she didn't need people to hold him down while she adjusted him, because she did it with a data pad. He could have been asleep. It would have been fine. And second of all, she has the flattened bullet, which essentially goes into his head. Mm-hmm. And she uses it to make sure it explodes after a certain... It's like, guns don't work that way. Where did you put it? Where in the gun did you put that to make it blow up? But it only blew up after 4 or 5 shots. That, I don't know.
I think she timed it so that...
Magic led, you're saying?
I don't know. I think she timed it so the fourth one was when she was right next to him. So I don't know. It doesn't make any sense.
Presumably she slipped in something and whatever bullet. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So that's a thing that happened. But Teddy was an interesting character. I like good Teddy, like sweet Teddy, who won't kill people Teddy. And then evil psychotic Teddy.
Was quite terrifying.
Yeah, bad Teddy.
But his performance was incredible, because there would be seconds, and it would literally be a second and a half, 2 seconds, where you would see the old Teddy kind of fighting in there. And the kind of, you'd see this moment of real pain etched on his face before he flipped back to being psychotic Teddy. Mm. And I thought actually James Marsden played it like beautifully, absolutely beautifully, because you could see him kind of fighting to come out. And some of those moments especially in the penultimate episode, I just thought were absolutely extraordinary.
I was a little bit more down on the Dolores Teddy stuff generally. For me, that was the slowest stuff in the season, because it just felt a bit... It didn't feel like they had enough for them to do, so it just felt like they were constantly travelling and doing monologues.
There was a lot of that. There was just a lot of aimless traipsing around. Also, don't even let's get started on the timelines of how long it takes to get from one place to another on horse, in a jeep, or on foot. Mm. Some inconsistencies there. I know what you mean. It got, I think, bogged down slightly in places. I didn't find them traipsing around as compelling as I found her journey, for example, with William in season 1, which I really enjoyed because I had no idea what was happening there. Mm. That was really good stuff. But I enjoyed those characters. I think Dolores is, again, this is a really good character. Mm. But again, there's consistency things which baffle me. Like, she essentially makes herself indestructible through sheer force of personality, it seems, whereas no one else, even Maeve, who has admin rights, is gifted with that particular power.
No.
Yeah, and I think it actually made her... There were moments where I felt, especially towards the end of the season, where she just became kind of a... not a boring, but she was a rampaging killing and revenge
Terminatrix.
Machine.
Terminatrix.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, amazing. And also awful. Yeah. Amazing.
No,
awful.
That's an actual thing. That's Terminator 3.
Terminator 3.
Yeah. Mm. Actual thing.
God.
Actual thing.
And I think you kind of lost a bit of the darkness and the light and shade of her character, which, you know, you rooted for her in season one, and she went to such a kind of a monotone place. And I actually kind of was really rooting for her to come back and have some of those, more of those quandaries and more of those dilemmas. And you know, at least the stuff with Teddy allowed her to kind of ask some fundamental questions of herself and why she decided to do stuff, and the role of the greater good and what was worth sacrificing and what wasn't. And to see her face some of those decisions in the last few episodes, because she just became this killing machine. And I think Maeve, actually, you know, Thandi Newton stole the season for me, because she was dealing with this new phenomenal power. I mean, she spent the whole episode, right, laying on the table with her guts hanging out. She'd never even, like, said anything until the last 3 seconds of the episode, and she was amazing. I was like, great.
She's
table
fantastic,
acting,
yeah.
Great table. But the character journey for her this season was just...
Mm. She's the MVP, isn't she, mate? Thandi Newton was fantastic in this. So good. Just whether it be, you know, emotional angst over the daughter who isn't her daughter, who's actually with another mother and doesn't even know who she is. So it's almost unrequited maternal love, which is a weird concept. And, you know, her sort of revenge thing and her sort of waking up to her powers, the way she relates with the other hosts, the way she relates with the humans.
She becomes Neo.
She does. She becomes the one. Mm. And I think she and Evan Rachel Wood probably both pleased. There was significantly less gratuitous nudity this season.
Yes.
Which is probably no bad thing.
There was a bit of Jeffrey Wright nudity.
There was. Always welcome.
By popular demand. But I guess they're pushing Dolores more towards villain territory, maybe because the show needs some hero. It needs people to root for and needs some people to root against. I think that you watch Game of Thrones and it's really clear who the good guys and the bad guys are, despite all the kind of, you know, grey areas. But Westworld is all grey sometimes. You watch it and you go, I'm not rooting for anyone. And it's quite hard to
They're all bell ends, aren't they? Just all of them.
Well, by the end of the second season, you'd got no good guys, no bad guys. No. I think, you know, the whole thing that those hats were meant to symbolise, the white hat and the black hat, that was completely gone. Yeah. Because actually what you'd got is a huge load of really complex characters. The man in black, you have sympathy for when you have this relationship with his daughter, and even when you work out why his wife did kill herself, you still somehow have some kind of empathy for this man who seems just hell-bent on suicide by the end, actually.
It's a deliberate counterpoint, because Westerns by their nature tend to be very binary, don't they? It is very white hat, black hat, and they obviously use that metaphor quite directly.
Well, the best, sort of the most noble characters at the end of season two are like the Native Americans and the prostitutes. Yeah. It's the cowboys who are all the biggest bastards.
Speaking of prostitutes, Clementine, I mean, really needs some lines and some character. Don't get me wrong, I loved her dead-eyed ride of death
that
where she
amazing.
Drove them all to kill each other, and it was a fantastic piece of cinematography, but she doesn't get particularly well served, does she, by the story?
No, not at all. I mean,
poor
literally
thing.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Because she's just a
virus,
she's just a
mobile virus, which seemed to affect most of the people, but not all of
Again,
them.
Consistency.
There were like sort of about 8 characters who weren't affected at all by it, and the others were. But that was a very memorable scene.
Also, they run for ages, and then Maeve stops everyone with her mind. It's like, why didn't you do that in the first place? But anyway,
she was waiting for the optimal moment for it to look cool.
It did look cool. But yeah, so we mentioned the Man in Black briefly. He's a good one to dwell on, because there's been some backlash against the Man in Black online, because he feels a bit one note and he's still banging around. And the question on everyone's minds has to be, how many bullets, what does it take to kill Ed Harris? Because by the end, he's been shot, 5, 6 times?
I mean, have you seen The Abyss?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. The man is a machine.
Well, he is, right?
Well, no, I don't believe he is. And I read up in this, I think... Okay, so we'll get into the Coda a little bit now. So the Coda... So there's a switcheroo. You see him, the gun explodes, his hand is hurt, he lies on the floor in the dirt. Bernard and Dolores go into the forge. Then you see him get up and walk into the lift. It comes down, Bernard walks into it, and he's not there. And my understanding from reading interviews and whatnot on this is that he doesn't get up. He is wounded and he gets shipped off because you see him on the beach being evacuated from the park. So he's, I think, at that point very human. I believe he has killed his daughter, his real daughter. Mm-hmm. I don't think she was a host. And then when you see him next, you see him, his consciousness in a host body, and you see him go into the forge, what looks like 50, 100 years in the future. I mean, there's dust and sand piled up about 3 feet high. Like, it's clearly a long way off. And it feels like he's being forced to relive his decisions over and over and again, which feels like a reference that Ford made to his own personal hell.
Mm, like he's, Delos.
It's a reverse of that scene, isn't it? Because it was him coming in and saying those lines to James Delos.
Exactly.
And they're just, he's now stuck in the and hell that he created for
someone else. A host of his
else.
Daughter talking to a host of him. Mm. And essentially, yeah, he's playing it out. And they've said this is something, it was kind of a tease that this is a whole other thing going on. This is a whole other timeline. And this is something they're going to pick up on in season three. Like, what is that and where is it going? Which was interesting, not least of all, because I think a lot of people probably missed it at the end of the credits.
Well, so I missed the sting just before I interviewed the showrunners because I didn't realise there was one, and then found out about it when they asked me what I thought about it. And it does change things because I did believe, I got to the end of the episode and I genuinely believed that he was a host. So I thought that his daughter absolutely wasn't. I thought he'd made a mistake and killed his human daughter. Mm. But I thought there is no way. And there is a scene when he's kind of... Yeah. And you can't tell what's inside his arm and if it's...
He's there for ages doing that.
That's him having an existential breakdown. I think at that point he's questioning his own reality. I think he is human, but he's... starting to wonder whether he is or not. Like, he doesn't know what's going on. I think he's just cracked at that point.
Yeah.
If he hadn't, in fact, beforehand, him and poor Lawrence. Honestly, the shit he puts Lawrence through.
But you do. I think it's... I quite liked him, as I say, in this season, because I did think, like, the whole flashback to his daughter and his wife.
Yeah.
And, you know, you think he's this monster, this unbelievable, evil guy. And when that moment when he sat on the bed with her and says, "I'm, you know, you see the darkness within me," it's still kind of something you can really relate to as a human being. We all have dark thoughts and moments of bad behaviour and moments of probably thinking we're evil. And he never makes the step to being that horrific monster you presume him to be. And you kind of think, you know, his wife was obviously challenged and she drank too much. And it was just such a human picture they painted, which I didn't expect, which made me... I think you have to start having some kind of sympathy or relatability with him, because otherwise he does become a cartoon villain who just gets shot a lot and literally gets back up again.
Yes,
I mean, there was the moment with Maeve and I was just like, hang on, didn't he just get shot five times? He's just like lying there looking a bit tired.
That's a mere flesh wound.
Yeah.
I will say that that is my least favourite stuff, the sort of Dallas-style sort of inner workings of the Delos family. Yes. All the stuff going on, there comes a point where I just don't care. Go back to the robots.
Yeah, I agree.
Ed Harris is incredible. His performance is incredible, there's no doubt, but it did start to get to the point where it would cut back to the man in black wandering around a forest.
And I was like, oh God, here we go again.
And it didn't feel like anything was happening in a lot of the scenes. He was just monologuing to someone and...
It feels to me like they don't want to keep the man in black, they just want to keep Ed Harris. It's one of these, Ed Harris is awesome, so they're finding things for him to do.
I mean, his face, that final shot, it's just a close-up of his craggy face with these blue eyes.
Yeah.
It was amazing. You know, that's better than any CG, Ed Harris's craggy face, but I don't know. I don't know whether they're going to bring it back. Maybe that's the end.
I think they've hinted they're going to pick up on that thread. But I didn't buy his character arc in the first season, where he goes from, you know, wide-eyed, super goody two-shoes, white hat William to this sort of raping, killing monster. And when he talks about you see the darkness within me, there was no hint of darkness when you first meet him at all. But fine, whatever.
What about Ford? Because you've got some strong views on Anthony Hopkins' wardrobe, at least.
Me?
You were saying the other day...
That man rocks a pocket watch.
His three-piece suit.
What was that saying?
You were saying he looked like a Charles Dickens...
Oh, yeah, he does a little bit.
rejected character from Charles Dickens.
No, I did say he just kept pitching up like the Ghost of Christmas Past. Do you know what I mean? He's like that ex-boyfriend who turns up in the pub every time you go home at Christmas, and you're like, oh, here he comes again, telling the same old story.
I really like Anthony Hopkins in this. I really like... And I was really happy he came back.
Even when he's make-believe.
Even when he is an imaginary Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah.
He's incredible. So I thought that at the beginning of the season there was an Anthony Hopkins-sized hole, and I was very happy that he came back. And I really liked all the stuff where he was just appearing behind people. Well, not people, but...
Well, it's not fully make-believe. It's his...
Well, the indication is when Bernard sees him in his head, he's not really there at the end.
At the end.
Yeah, but so he is before he erases him.
Yeah, because think about the little boy he pops up in.
Yeah. But the Halores plan is all Bernard's, even though he thinks Ford gave it to him.
Yes, or did Ford make him think that he thought it was his?
Whoa! Feints within feints within feints.
But all the kind of, you know, evil Walt Disney, the way that... Any robot could talk with his voice and all that stuff.
That stuff was
really
great
well
and wasn't used well enough. And I think that was a thing that disappointed me a little, that I thought that he had this overarching malevolent plan. Mm. You know, whether or not it was aimed at the Man in Black or not, I liked the idea that they could all speak with his voice. A little bit like, you know, like you see in horror films when the devil sort of speaks through children and stuff like that to taunt the protagonist. And I thought that was great. But again, it just sort of faded into nothing and it turned out that Ed Harris was just delusional. So that's nice.
Mm.
Felt like a bit of a missed opportunity. Mm. But no, I thought Ford is kind of fun in this. What did we think of Tessa Thompson's Charlotte Hale?
A bit pointless until the end.
Yeah.
They're kind of just holding her there until the reveal. And I was, at one point, I think I was watching like episode 9 and just thinking, why is Tessa Thompson doing this show? Because they've given her nothing to do.
Yeah.
And then I watched the finale. I was like, ah, that's why. But it felt like she was just a pointless character until the reveal.
Unnecessarily dickish.
I mean, the classic TV bitch, right? Which is the kind
of corporate,
heartless woman who has to be 50 times harder than any man around her. You know, the kind of Thatcher effect, I always call it. And in that way, I felt like it was clumsy because you knew there was a twist coming because that couldn't just be her character. Because it was so poorly conceived and so thin compared to everybody else that the only questions really was she going to just be a host? What was the deal? Because it just seemed ridiculous. As you say, she got nothing, especially compared to the other female characters.
Mm-hmm.
So I have feelings about Lee Sizemore, right?
Do we need to leave? Do you need to be on your own?
So Lee, so in episode 5, he had a few lines that was so meta about the screenwriting process. You know, you want to try writing 8 narratives on 3 different timelines, which did make me laugh. And I actually kind of liked the kind of levity he brought at times, especially when things were getting really blood. I mean, that episode was so bloody and hardcore. And I actually really liked the fact they gave him this little hero's arc at the end. So when he's left behind, and what does he say? You sleep on the broken bodies of those who were here before you. And he's like desperate to do this speech that he'd written for himself. Goes down in, you presume, because you don't see it, but you hear it, in a hail of bullets. And I really loved it. I loved that this guy who is, you know, not your average, especially in a physical sense, not your average TV hero, and was kind of, you know, the brains of the outfit to some regard, and was the guy writing storylines. The fact that they allowed him to have this, to write his own hero's arc at the end, I thought was a lovely touch.
It just annoyed me because it was utterly unnecessary.
They
killed him in less than three seconds.
I must say, it seemed like the world's worst decoy.
And they were saying, throw down the gun and come out. And, you know, and that might have actually delayed them more than being shot.
But it was selfish. But I thought it was actually, you can read it as meta, right? Which is self-indulgent writers doing things for effect as opposed to narrative consequence.
I didn't think he delivered the lines pretty well, which may have been deliberate because it may have just been showing that he's not an actor.
He's a writer. Yeah.
He shouldn't be doing that. But I thought they grappled with that character a bit because when they introduced him in season 1, he was really evil, wasn't he? Like, he was one of the, you thought this guy's going to be the real villain of the show. I think they struggled slightly to work out how to fit him in. But I enjoyed him more in season 2, I thought, as the kind of dweeby sort of, you know, sidekick stroke commentary.
Yeah, he had some moments. And I think he was useful in drawing out some of the Maeve stuff. I mean, we touched on Kitsuyu a little bit, but another one of the standalone episodes I really enjoyed, it wasn't really standalone, but a small arc, was the Shogun World arc.
Mm.
I really, really loved that. That was a world I thought was fantastic. And I liked the idea that, oh, Westworld is like, that's your training wheels. This is fucking hardcore. You know, everyone's getting hacked up with swords. It's full on. This is for people for whom Westworld is too tame.
Yeah, and there are, what, 3 more worlds that haven't even been revealed as the season ends?
So we've seen Raj World, haven't
we? Raj World, which just looked... I mean,
that looked
shit,
didn't it?
That was rubbish. I was like, if I'd ended up there, I'd have been like, I want a refund.
Come on, people. Robot elephants.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Raj World is shit. Yeah,
I liked the robot tiger.
I enjoyed the, like, tea on the lawn with the robot tiger leaping from a bush.
I mean, it would just be lots of cups of tea.
Yes.
Yeah.
A lot of tea. But Shogun World was mental. And I enjoyed the fact that it was all in Japanese. I just, oh, so good.
Yeah, and then episode 8, which is, remind me of the episode name.
Episode 8 is Kiksuya, and that, I mean, think, is unarguably the season high point.
It's for me, it is one of the most extraordinary pieces of television I can remember watching, whether it's from a cinematography perspective. I mean, the script is exquisite. And think about how radical it is, really, right? You've got Westworld, which is a huge show for a Western English-speaking audience, and most of it was subtitled because obviously it was told from the perspective of Akita. And the story was simplistic and heartfelt, and it really took me back to the heart of the show around kind of the damage that can be done to people's lives and loss and grief and what makes us love and what makes us human. It just absolutely felt so moved by this episode, and for me was really Westworld at its kind of best. There's no huge layers of complication, there's no huge twists just to like mess with you. It's just simple and beautiful and heartfelt, and I really felt like they meant it with this episode, whereas I think sometimes there's a sense of being really smart and kind of foxing the viewer a little bit and kind of messing with them in terms of their memory and what they think they know and what they think they don't know. So, as I say, I think it's just one of the best episodes of TV
incredibly,
I can remember.
It's incredibly well executed. The idea that underneath the ground is metaphorical, not metaphorical, but the place where he has to journey on this kind of spirit quest. He has to kill himself to get there, and it's fantastic.
It's a risky thing to do, because you get this a lot in shows where they pick out a minor or completely obscure character and dedicate an episode to it, and oftentimes they are this is season filler, this is interminable, oh for fuck's sake, what's going on? But he was so good, and made extraordinarily good, because you'd seen him so many times, and he'd just been Ghost Nation, two-dimensional baddie, and in one episode they turn the most two-dimensional cardboard cutout character into one of the deepest, most emotionally fulfilled characters in the show. So much so that the big, heart impact moment is when he's reunited with his wife.
Yeah.
And, fair play to them. That's an extraordinary bit of writing.
It's radical, as you say, it had been built around these tropes, right? These, as you say, painted faces and barbarians, and they'd been presented as wordless savages. And the fact that these are the saviours all along, and it makes you think about the presumptions of the people on the show, but also you watching as an audience, where you'd place them on the kind of moral compass and the good guys, bad guys.
There's an interesting counterpoint to the real world there, I think, slightly, when we look at faceless savages.
But
that's a really, really good episode. I think that's undoubtedly my favourite. I also did enjoy the Peter Mullen episode, which I thought was very, very good. Just because it comes out of nowhere. That's a really interesting... That's the big rug pull, isn't it? That's the episode where you finally find out, which is episode 4, Riddle of the Sphinx, you finally find out what the park is and what it's for.
Mm. It's also the name of an Inside Number 9 episode, I think, Riddle of the Sphinx.
Oh, perhaps crossword a direct reference to that.
Nobody pours milk with the intensity of Peter Mullen. it's kind of a vision of hell, isn't it, really? It's trapped in this room.
Or being trapped with Peter Mullen in a room. It's harsh.
He is phenomenal in this. They did a very good job shipping him in.
He's the kind of guy, he does sort of simmering rage so well. He's the kind of person I definitely wouldn't want to get a bollocking from. I think that would go badly for me.
So you shouldn't make up a song about him?
No. No. Well, he knows that we sing about him when we have karaoke night, so it's fine.
Okay.
Peter Mullen. What else stood out for you this season? Is there anything else you wish to talk about? For example, where will it go next?
Christ. I mean, the outside world, right? So I think that the thing that Dolores was after all along, and actually for me, you thought you were following Bernard's quest, but actually you were following Dolores's quest, which was to be given the opportunity to build their own world and everything that entails. And I think that's the starting point for where we are in season 3.
Yeah.
But as I say, we've got 3 worlds as yet unrevealed.
They have to go back to the parks.
Yeah, but the parks exist. Also, as you say, where are all those souls now? Where is all that consciousness? Are the people who crossed over into Utopia completely dead?
Yeah. Will the Sublime come back?
Will the Sublime come back? Can it ever reopen? What happened to all the characters that we thought died? There's a lot of questions, but I think obviously the outside world, if season 2 was all about trying to reach whatever was on the other side of the door, and they have, that'll be interesting in terms of how they paint the real world and how they live within the real world. But then how, presumably, as you say, they're going to have to go back to the park.
They should make it that somebody has forgotten something important. They have to, all of them have to go all the way back to, like, Sweetwater. No, I think they should have Reddit World. I think they should have a world that is just Westworld fans trying to work out what's happening on Westworld, but they're all robots.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It's going to be a nice counterpoint to Jurassic World 3, isn't it, but with robots. Mm. So you're going to have Dolores, whoever Charlotte Hale is, and out, and whoever she uses with the other pearls she has, trying to basically kill all humans and take over the world. And then Bernard, bless him, on his own, trying to stop them. Wow, that's a mismatch, isn't it? Meanwhile, we'll find out what's happening with the Man in Black way in the future.
Mm. Yeah.
And what's happening there.
Who knows?
Who knows or dares to dream? Yeah. We do have a few questions from Ben J. Clues, at Ben J. Clues. For the first time in Westworld, I noticed the aspect ratio repeatedly changed over the course of the episode. Do you think this means anything besides bad planning on the part of the camera crew? No. They deliberately, I believe, and timeline. I know this because I read it, they use anamorphic lenses for one of the timelines to show... Yeah. Clearly what it is. I think it becomes more obvious in the last episode because they don't do it quite so subtly. But yeah, that's deliberate, so you know what timeline you're in. At Ugly Biker says, love the episode in Shogun World. However, in terms of the whole plot, was it arguably a bit self-indulgent? Maeve discovering her powers could have been done a bit quicker. That being said, samurai fights and mid-head decapitations were a highlight.
Well, I think, as we were saying earlier, that episode and episode 8 both arguably are self-indulgent, but for me were lovely kind of pauses because the kind of intensity and the number of oh, God, just what is happening, psychotic moments that you have during one normal episode of Westworld. For me, they were lovely breathers and they were lovely kind of moments to remind me what I love about the show. And just as the pace change, it was really great. So I think it's definitely self-indulgent, but I didn't mind it.
It felt almost like an anthology show, you know. Yeah. Say different people were coming in and telling stories within this world, what would people do? And they felt very refreshing, like different changes of voice. To the main thing, which
I do think self-indulgence is something this series is guilty of. It's an interesting one, isn't it? So it's 10 episodes, so it's not overtly long. Like, it's not as interminable as some of Netflix's Marvel shows. But the problem is, like, something like Game of Thrones has a real velocity to it. You know where it's going. You feel very... You don't feel like there's any flab in that. Whereas in this, it feels a lot like at the end of the season, you've seen the finale, you think, oh, Westworld season 2 was great. Yet if you'd asked me at numerous points during the season, I'd have been like, oh, Jesus Christ, I've got to watch another Westworld. Like, at no point was I like, oh, I am so compelled to watch the next one. And I think it maybe needs a little bit more of that. You need to want to watch it as much as you enjoy having watched it once you've seen how it all plays out.
It takes a huge commitment, I think, and that's mental commitment, right? And that can be quite exhausting. I'm feeling exactly the same at the moment with Handmaid's Tale. Like, that takes a different kind of mental commitment. But as you say, you kind of psych yourself up for watching it, which is great. Yeah. But like, and afterwards you're like, that was amazing. But there's something kind of that you know you're going to be put through the ringer a little bit, mentally and intellectually.
Yeah.
I wonder whether there's a problem there with TV generally, that you've got Westworld, which is massively nihilistic. You've got, you know, Handmaid's Tale, which is massively nihilistic. You've got The Walking Dead, which is massively nihilistic. And then you've got The News, which is massively nihilistic. And it just feels, for the love of Christ, can we just have an extended season of Derry Girls or something to make us feel alive?
This is why I'm watching Desperate Housewives.
I do not blame you. I'm seriously considering
it. I just want
it.
Something that's trashy and fun.
Yeah.
And so I resort to that. But you're right. But I think, just going back to the pacing thing, you know, it's interesting. Game of Thrones is now sped up, so I think that almost highlights how slow this moves and how long they're taking to get the piece in place. Because you watch the latest season of Game of Thrones, it just flies by at dragon speed.
It does.
But I mean, it's there are great. I think Westworld, there are great bits and there are not so great bits, and I think the great bits probably highlight the fact that when it does drag, it's not as good as that.
And speaking of dragon speed, similar question here from at Damo RK, who says, what's the deal with travel times in this show? Charlotte and her mob left the Mesa before Maeve, in jeeps no less, but somehow Maeve and her mob arrive at the door before them. And I believe the answer to that is, shut up, don't ask questions.
Magic jeeps.
Yeah.
They go slowly.
Magic jeeps. They took a wrong term. Frankly, Waze was playing up and it went all around the Mesa and something like that. At Mr. Chris T says, was Sizemore's change in behaviour really likely? Had he fallen head over heels with Maeve? Do we think it was a love thing there? I'm not sure that it was an attraction.
I thought it was respect.
Yeah, I think he did. I think he was at first fascinated by her as a technological marvel. Mm. But I think, yes, it was respect and she's very charismatic. Mm. And I think he bought into her emotional journey and that she wanted to find her daughter.
Yeah, I think he supported fundamentally that bit of her quest, and he then saw it his job to protect her and to help her. But I think, yeah, it was huge respect as opposed to sexual attraction.
Yes.
Don't know why I'm saying it in that voice either.
Yeah, that's not weird at all. At Dan the Busker says, with the attention to detail that Westworld puts into every episode, are there any other TV series or films that are as satisfying to rewatch after understanding the motivations of each of the characters? Westworld becomes a different beast when watching again.
Well, I kind of, my first thought is Breaking Bad. Just, I think that's a great rewatch show, because once you know where it's going, it's quite satisfying to go back and see all the little hints of things, and that a lot of thought goes into that show, the colour schemes and all kinds of stuff. But I don't, in terms of puzzling over it,
no, I think this is quite unique in that way. Like I've been watching some of the episodes 2 and 3 times, and I then use the information I've gathered in the first viewing to help me with my second and third. But I have to watch it multiple times to fully understand it. And I don't know if there is another show out there with so many kind of narrative complications and fractures and subplots and timelines that demands the same of you. I think there are plenty of things I love watching over and over again. I'm just watching Catastrophe for literally like the sixth time. But that's for pure enjoyment. Whereas I feel like if you only watch Westworld, each episode you only watch it once, and there's always some kind of reveal towards the end of the episode, then you've probably not understood 30% of what's come before.
I mean, was Lost the last big one like this? I mean, I'm not saying it worked, but no, the last one that did as many kind of...
I really enjoyed Lost. I think the problem you have with Lost is when you rewatch this, you see the foreshadowing, you see the plans to a certain extent. With Lost, I think the opposite is true. You see them fumbling around in the dark, and it's clear they don't know what
they're
doing.
It didn't work, but just in terms of the experimenting with the form, with the flashbacks that turned into flash forwards, they were kind of messing around with structure in a similar way. The difference is this feels a lot more confident. It feels like they know where they're going a little bit more.
I don't know if they do,
but I have more faith in these guys for some reason. And Nolan is involved.
Yes.
And I think they plan ahead.
Okay.
The Nolans. They make their sandwiches in advance.
Time for a couple more questions. At Keem Bearlay says, do you think season 3 should be the final season? There's some sense in that. Like, I worry that the longer something like this goes on, and the longer they try and repeat a narrative structure where there's a puzzle to be worked out, that it starts to get a little bit stale, a little bit tired. I think there's some sense in quitting while you're ahead, going out on a high. I don't know. Is this sustainable over the long term? I know Jonathan Nolan has said he's outlined the scene he thinks ends the show, and as yet they haven't seen a reason to deviate from that. Obviously, he hasn't said what that is.
I mean, I suppose, right, if the fundamental premise and point of the show remains as it has been, then you probably have only got one more season to go. You'd have to kind of reinvent the basic premise of it to go beyond that, I think. You'd have to kind of move it on completely, which then would make it a completely different TV show, because it is quite a contained story in many respects, and there's only so many places to go with the host versus human. The way the whole thing has been structured, the fundamental questions that are asked at the heart of it, once they have been answered or explored, I don't know where else you go.
There's some more scope. I think it's not the kind of problem they had with Prison Break, you know, where it's like, no. Right, we're end of season one, they're out of the prison. Shit.
Yeah.
Although they still went on for another 4 or 5 seasons.
I mean, they killed off the main character and then brought him back.
Yeah, and they've escaped from a lot of prisons at this point.
Yeah. My prediction for this is 5 seasons.
5? You think 5?
And a film. No, just 5. Just 5 seasons.
Okay.
That's my prediction. I have no evidence for this.
Okay. A last question. This is from at Keem Bearlay again. What other world would you like to see? I'm saying Nazi world.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Jurassic world.
Yes.
I mean, we did a crossover. Talk about this the other day, like dinosaurs. Like
Dino world. Good.
What about, I want like Alton Towers world. So it's just like roller coasters.
Chessington World of Adventures world.
Yeah, Chessington.
Probably don't need hosts for that, do you?
Oh, I just want to go to the... I want to go on a roller coaster.
Because the host would all just be sort of teenage, you know, uni students.
Yeah.
Like operating the roller coasters. I've said before on this, I'm expecting them to go into Westeros world, thereby completing completing the HBO cinematic universe.
Yes,
where it's all tied together.
Robotic Sean Beans.
Yeah, it'll
everywhere.
Happen. It'll happen.
Why not?
I know. What else is there? Like we've had a lot of
Renaissance world,
caveman world.
Yeah,
you could have knights. Medieval world was obviously one that Crichton. So there were in the original sort of film, there was reference to medieval. You saw medieval world, and there was future world, which was the sequel.
Oh, future world. Yes.
I mean, future world is slightly redundant at this point, isn't it?
Yeah,
a little bit. It's like, oh, look. I don't know. Moon world.
80s world. Where they would just sit around in shoulder pads.
They did that in Black Mirror.
Yeah, I was going to say, that is Black Mirror. That's amazing Black Mirror episode.
Camden world. I don't know.
Oh, God. We're living in Camden world.
We literally are.
We're living that dystopian nightmare.
Yeah, we're in a studio in Camden world. Well, on that note, I think we're done. These violent delights have violent ends. And with that, I believe Empire's Westworld spoiler special is complete. Join us on Friday for the regular pod and shortly thereafter our Jurassic World spoiler special, which I think we're recording later this week. Until then, it is goodbye from Terry.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Nick.
Bye-bye.
And goodbye from me. We are all off to spend the afternoon in the Sublime, a place without copy deadlines, press days, or screenings of the Overboard remake. Goodbye.